from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The way Pete Peterson sees it, two giant deficits are about to spoil America's economic future, and the country's two major political parties are not doing a thing to stop it. Tonight on Point, as deficits climb, a big-time warrior against red ink says the country is in serious trouble and offers a painful way out. But first tonight, hundreds of thousands of residents have fled New Orleans in the past 24 hours, running from the fear of a direct hit by Hurricane Ivan. The city's mayor has urged everyone left behind to make a vertical evacuation and head to the highest floors of tall buildings. Joining me now from mid-city New Orleans is James Airy, producer for WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. James, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you.
So give us the picture down there right now. We should say it appears as though what we're seeing is Ivan has veered off to the east a little bit. It's more directly aimed at Mobile at this hour than at New Orleans. Is that correct?
Yeah, our thoughts are certainly going out to our friends and relatives and colleagues from Gulfport to Mobile Bay to Pascagoula. Certainly, they are facing the brunt of Hurricane Ivan as the eye now predicted to move ashore there near Mobile probably around 2:30, 3 o'clock, sometime early tomorrow morning. Here in the Crescent City, we sit kind of in a bowl between the Mississippi River and Lake Pontchartrain. And Lake Pontchartrain, a large inland lake, it's actually about the size of Rhode Island, but the city itself about 10 feet below sea level in parts. Wow, the wind's really starting to pick up here.
I hear it.
We're worried about flooding right now. The rain has not yet begun, and clearly you can hear the winds behind me about 45, 50 miles an hour already. We're worried about flooding here. As the storm surge gets closer to the coast in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, only about 10 to 12 inches of rain are predicted, but as the floodwaters come in from the Gulf, that's certainly something that everyone is keeping their eye on. A lot of folks here remembering what happened with Hurricane Betsy and just devastating flooding, and that was in 1965. And Hurricane Ivan is one step worse than Betsy. Betsy was a Category 3. Ivan right now is still a Category 4.
James, we know that for the past couple of days, nobody knew exactly where this was going to land. New Orleans has had a lot of tension, and there's been a lot of preparation underway there. We've seen the images of thousands and thousands of people fleeing the city. Who's left? Who's still there? And those who are still there, what are they doing?
Well, there are certainly the fools like I am that are still here. Remarkably, where I live in the city here in the middle part of the city, mid-city as it's called, quite a few people have stayed behind. We're sort of on higher ground even within that bowl that the city is shaped as. Lots of cars parked in people's yards, up on embankments. This hurricane has really taken a similar track to one about 6 years ago in 1988 called George. It also happened in September. Wind and rain, the main focus of George as well. Lots of damage in the Caribbean for days and days. People said it's coming right at New Orleans, and then about 36 hours ahead of time, it took that turn to the north and then finally to the east and slammed into Mobile Bay. So really an eerie carbon copy of 6 years ago playing itself out now. 6 years ago, Hurricane George, and this September, Hurricane Ivan.
But do you have a sense, James, of what portion of the city has left town and what portion remains behind?
It's very, very peculiar. Driving from the radio station, from the NPR station out at the lakefront here to mid-city, which is about a four-mile drive, I saw two cars on the highway and one gentleman out walking his two German shepherds. The city is really boarded up and battened down. The people that left took everything out of their yards and packed it away safely so we wouldn't have any flying projectiles later tonight and early tomorrow morning with yard signs and patio furniture going every which way. The people that have stayed behind, and here's a pickup truck coming right by me now. That's the first truck that I've actually seen out on the road. We're actually live on the radio right now with National Public Radio in Boston.
Oh, really? Let me talk to you.
Yeah. Okay.
We are live in New Orleans.
I can give you my cell phone right now. gentleman driving by reminding us that we are under a curfew right now, and that actually is true. I need to be inside, as according to the mayor's wishes.
This is a curfew that went into effect at 2 p.m., very early in the day.
Went into effect at 2 p.m., that's exactly right. A lot of the officers were up on the interstate earlier today, making sure that once they had put the traffic curfew into effect, that people were not getting on or off the interstate, any of the bridges that go over water, things like that, but also a residential curfew now in effect. Pretty much dusk to dawn in the areas closer to the water, but here in the city, we're under a curfew from 2 p.m., and that's in effect until dawn tomorrow
morning. And we heard right there from the patrol, they are serious about it, off the cell phone and inside,
serious.
Mister.
I think he's going to let, I'm about 300 yards from my house out here closer to the water's edge, so I think he was probably giving me some rather sage advice. The airport is closed. Local transportation here is suspended. They're going to stop running the streetcars at midnight tonight. Trash pickup mail service is suspended. Again, flooding and rain, the main concerns, along with the winds here in the Crescent City, and then further to our east with the landfall of Ivan, probably 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock tomorrow morning. The hurricane-force winds are extending out about 100 miles, so we're probably going to get 70 miles, 75-mile-an-hour winds, and some pretty significant rain by dawn tomorrow morning. But I guess you would categorize the mood in the city as cautiously optimistic right now. Since the storm took that turn to the east, everyone kind of has their fingers crossed through the nightfall tonight.
Well, it sounds like a bit of a ghost town there in New Orleans, but Ivan is on his way. James Erie, be safe, and thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and I look forward to coming and visiting you in Boston again soon.
Come on up. Run on up if you can.
Soon enough. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you. James Erie is a producer for WWNO. He joined me from New Orleans. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office is out with an assessment of George Bush's tax and spending proposals this week. And it's a picture to chill a deficit hawk's heart. Trillions in red ink for years. John Kerry, says the CBO, is a little better, but not much. Former Commerce Secretary Peter Peterson will second that and up the ante. U.S. budget deficits and indebtedness to foreigners are a vast and growing threat to American assumptions of affluence and security, he says in a new book. And the country is in trouble. Tonight on Point, running on empty with Peter Peterson and some tough solutions to a big problem. Do you understand why the International Monetary Fund is talking to the USA like it's a fiscal banana republic? Are Republicans and Democrats equally to blame even after Clinton's surpluses and Bush's deficit? Has the American dream become unsustainable? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is former Secretary of Commerce Peter Peterson. He was former CEO of Lehman Brothers and Bell and Howell, Commerce Secretary under Richard Nixon, co-founder of the Concord Coalition with Warren Rudman and Paul Tsongas. He is currently Chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is Running on Empty, How the Democratic and Republican Parties Are Bankrupting Our Future and What We Can Do About It. Good evening and welcome, Pete Peterson.
Good evening to you, sir.
Thanks for being with us. Also with me in the studio tonight is news analyst Jack Beatty, editor at the Atlantic Monthly and editor of the new book, Paul's Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan. And a wonderful book it is. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. And hello, Pete. Nice to talk to you.
Well, Jack, you and I did a few covers, didn't we, for Atlantic Monthly?
You've been at this a long time and good for you, too.
So, Pete Peterson, give us your latest blast. It's not the first time we've heard from you on deficits. Paul Tsongas and you and Warren Rudman were out there years ago, and here you are at it again. What is the new angle on what you've been decrying for a long, long time, Pete Peterson?
Well, I think there are three or four things that are really quite new. In the first place, when I was working with Jack at Atlantic Monthly in the 80s and the New York Review of Books, this thing we called the baby boomer entitlement problem was, 25 years off, and given this country's aggravated case of short-termitis, that seemed like, something for somebody else to worry about.
An eternity.
Today, 77 million boomers, which will lead to an elderly population twice the size of the current one, begin retiring in only 5 years. So whereas in previous times, leaders of countries could indicate what Lady Thatcher indicated to me once, and let me tell you that brief anecdote because it illustrates the problem.
Yeah.
She is the only developed country leader who took action on a timely basis on their Social Security program. And I asked Lady Thatcher once, what do you people talk about at those G7 meetings? Are they aware of this coming flood tide? And why don't they do something about it? And she said, oh, my, yes, Mr. Peterson, they're very much aware of it. But their political attitude is going to hit on somebody else's watch. And why should I take the pain for somebody else's gain? Well, this time, the next president, and all presidents, I believe, look forward to 8 years, will be looking right into the teeth of this problem, and it could hit on their watch. So that's something that is quite different.
It's imminent.
It's more or less imminent. Secondly, there is a colossal mismatch between what we are say we must do and having the resources to do it. One of those areas is national security requirements. And we are having great trouble even discussing the trade-offs between national security, retirement security, economic security, and a huge human capital and infrastructure agenda that we should be talking about. So, now, let's look at national security. Mm-hmm. In my book, I went to the best experts I could find, and I asked them what they thought were reasonable estimates of what our defense budgets could be, should be, compared to what they are now.
Okay.
What I discover, for example, is the Congressional Budget Office, which, after all, is approved by the Republican Party, believes that the budget estimates are $1 trillion understated over the next 10 years. And they remind us that there's nothing in those budgets for any wars. And in particular, there's nothing in those budgets for adding more troops, even though 54 out of 61 members of the Armed Services Committee believe we should have more troops. And they're all complaining about having a 10-division army for a 12-division set of objectives. And we're seeing the effects of that, of course, in Iraq.
This goes to the dishonesty charge that you make, Pete Peterson,
that
Washington is simply not owning up to the reality of America's fiscal circumstance.
Precisely. And then we've got Homeland Security, and we keep saying, of course, that there's nothing more important than American safety at home. The Council of Foreign Relations, through Steve Flynn, has done an enormous amount of work on this, and I just have to report that any reasonable person would conclude that the vast majority of the problems on Homeland Security are unaddressed. I'm talking about our ports that are terribly underprotected at the moment, our nuclear facilities, our first responders, which, as we saw with the Twin Towers, were very poorly equipped, our medical health care system for biological weapons, the whole panoply of our infrastructure, pipelines, chemical facilities. And there are hundreds of billions of dollars would be required to match reality.
And again, none of that factored into the deficit projections that we're seeing.
None of that is factored into any of these estimates that you're hearing about. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, we have the fact that we don't have just one deficit now. We have what is called a twin deficit. And all Americans are more or less aware of the budget deficit. Many few of them are aware of a deficit that they're going to be hearing a lot more of.
And that's the indebtedness to foreign debt holders. Pete Peterson, we'll be right back to talk about that. We've got to take a short break. We are talking tonight about America's deficit problem and a warning of big trouble no matter who wins November 2nd. My guest is Pete Peterson, author of Running on Empty, How the Democratic and Republican Parties Are Bankrupting Our Future and What Americans Can Do About It. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's deficit problem, maybe problems, and a warning of big trouble no matter who wins on November 2nd. My guest is Pete Peterson, former Commerce Secretary under Richard Nixon. He's been a deficit hawk for a long time, and he's turning up the volume now. His new book is Running on Empty. He says the United States is in big trouble. It's being treated, and with good reason, like a banana republic by the International Monetary Fund, and America's assumptions of security, financial, retirement, economic, of the American dream itself may be misplaced. And he points a finger of blame at both parties, Republican and Democrat. The book is Running on Empty. You can join the conversation tonight. Is America living dangerously beyond its means? And if so, when do you think the crunch will come? Soon? Ever? And are Republicans and Democrats living in la-la land? Are they equally to blame? Are you living in la-la land, assuming prosperity goes on forever and deficits be damned? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pete Peterson, you were saying, and I think Americans are much less kind of versed in this than they were a decade ago when the Concord Coalition had the volume really cranked up on this problem. And before
And Ross Perot.
Yes, quite so. But we know about the deficit, though we lived without it for a while. We thought it had gone away. But the second one you're looking at is the so-called current account deficit, the money essentially owed to foreigners.
Yes. In other words, countries are like people. When you spend more than you produce, you have to borrow the difference. And we're obviously spending a lot more than we're producing. All you have to do is look at this $600 billion, trade deficit. Now, let me give you an idea how big it is now. It is running at an unprecedented 5.7% of the GDP, or over $600 billion. Now, to give you a little reference point, the previous record was in the 80s, you know, in the Reagan years,
yep,
when it hit 3.7%. So it's now 60% larger, roughly, than it was. And then you may recall the dollar fell by a third. We experienced some stock market problems that Jack Beatty will remember, because one of my articles came out about that time, and people thought I was remarkably prescient. That was actually just dumb luck. And we got bailed out there by a huge drop in oil prices. But today we are in absolutely uncharted, unthinkable territory. We have to import $4 billion of foreign capital every workday. We need half of that to finance these deficits. We need half of it to finance investment, because we've gone from being the biggest saver in the world to being the lousiest saver in the world.
$4 billion
so
a day.
Pete
Peterson, I want to get to your solutions. I want to hear from Jack. But to make it clear why this all matters, I wish you would go straight to the bottom line of what you fear may happen if these twin deficits, these two deficits, are not addressed. What could unfold here that would stun and, as you describe it, maybe impoverish Americans?
Because I'm not an expert in global capital markets, I interviewed 12 of the smartest people I know, including Paul Volcker, Bob Rubin, people like that.
Mm-hmm.
I asked them about current account deficits at anything like this level. Not one of the 12 believes they are sustainable. And in the immortal words of Herb Stein, if something's unsustainable, it tends to stop. Or he said, if the horse dies, we suggest you dismount.
So when the music dies, what happens? Americans don't really have experience.
Okay, let's talk about it. There are two scenarios. Half of the experts I talked to believe that we are headed to what they call a hard landing or a crash landing. What is that? A hard landing, for reasons that no one can safely predict. Paul Volcker believes the chances are 75% within 5 years. The dollar falls very sharply. Interest rates go way up. It has not only has nasty effects on financial markets and the economy, but it has very nasty effects, obviously, on people, on mortgages and all that sort of thing. And it involves profound costs. The other half say, well, we think the odds are, and everybody knows there are risks here, that you'll have a softer landing. Now, make no mistake about it. Even in the softer landing, it's a landing, and it's not a takeoff. And under these circumstances, these changes take place, but still more gradually. But overall, the world is now in an unsustainable state of imbalance, and we are going to have to consume less, we're going to have to import less, we're going to have to export more, and very important, we're going to have to save more.
Does this mean that America's affluence is on the way out? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, I'm saying we are taking a great risk that a great country like ours should not take. Now, the relevance of budget deficits is think of them as negative savings. If you have a savings pool in a country, the layer that comes off first are the deficits because the government has, you know, the good faith and credit of the United States of America.
Right.
Now, the bigger that deficit is, the less savings you have. Now, why is that important? It's very important because savings are what you need to invest, and investment is what you need in order to grow.
Okay, we've got a big picture here. We want to get to the political angle on this. We won't miss that, but I want to get Jack in here. Jack, you've known Pete for a long time and is concerned about deficits for a long time. He says, look, it's bigger, it's worse. And the potential crunch here is much more imminent than it was the last time this was so big on America's screen. How do you see the kind of fire alarm that Pete Peterson is raising?
Well, I think we need to hear it and loud and clear. The Treasury Department estimated a $44 trillion funding gap over 75 years. But the trouble is we have a politics of unreality. I mean, Republicans hate taxes. I think the only time George Bush used the word unjust in his presidency, at least to my memory, was when he was referring to the double taxation of dividends. At the Republican convention, the loudest applause was on cutting the evil of government and cutting taxes. On the other hand, the Democrats represent people who feel aggrieved, people who feel very sensitive to changes in entitlements. In 1992, Paul Tsongas wrote a book which advocated really, you know, very moderate changes in Social Security, but really was facing up to the problem. Well, he was running in a presidential primary, and Bill Clinton said, that mine enemy has written a book. Mm-hmm. And he went down there in Florida and just took out ads that said, this guy wants to cut your benefits, and that was the end of Paul Tsongas. So unreality on that side, unreality, massive unreality on the Republican side about taxes. Pete, how do we do it? How do you get the parties with these constituents to change?
Pete Peterson.
Well, let's just talk about both parties because I have a relentless need to offend everyone.
Okay. We're in the same boat. Go for it.
Okay. The Republican Party, my party, are theologians in the sense that their points of view seem to me, at least, to be faith-directed and relatively untouched by evidence or history. Now, my party has three different groups with very different theologies or points of view. We have the any tax cut, any time, you know, theology, namely that we can grow out of any problem. Secondly, we have a whole new category that used to be an oxymoron called the big government Republican. And we've had an absolute spending explosion in an administration where we have the president and both Congress, and the Congress and the Senate, controlled by the same party. Mm-hmm. And this isn't just Pete Peterson saying it. The Cato Institute, Pat Buchanan, Dick Armey, everybody is saying,
it's
my
in the
God,
numbers.
Spending is out of control. Then we have another cute, quirky group in my party called Star of the Beasters. Now, they say all the supply-siders are all wet. Of course, you're right. Revenues are going to go down if you cut taxes, and that's what we want because we want to get rid of those damn government benefit programs. Now, I say to these guys, I want to be sure that you guys don't get what you wish for. We got 77 million boomers. A third of Americans at the age of 65 have saved nothing in terms of net savings. The bottom fifth of the elderly group today depends on Social Security for 91% of what they have. Mm. Now, I said, you guys are telling me that you're going to have 25 or 30 million Americans, And they are going to approach retirement, and one bright sunny day, you're going to tell them, sorry, folks, there are no benefits. And what do you expect to happen? You expect them to say, thank you, I needed that, I deserved that for my profligacy? Or do you think there might be some very profound social and political effects? Now, the Democrats have their own theology. They haven't met a universal entitlement they didn't like or, you know, want to expand. And during the time when they were more or less in charge, though there was some Republican help, federal benefits to individuals across the board went up 6 times after inflation. So you see on the current Medicare prescription drug debate, you know, that went through.
Sure, sure.
I don't know of a serious student of Medicare who believes it's sustainable, given the explosion of elderly and the explosion of health care costs. What is their complaint about that particular bill? That it doesn't go nearly far enough. So you have an unholy conspiracy, if I can mix my metaphors, of two different theologies, all of which end up not only in a highly dubious fiscal and economic equation, but I argue a very immoral equation.
Pete Peterson, let me ask you on that point. We'll finish the thought, but I want to just get in on that point. The 1990s saw Bill Clinton in charge for 2 terms, and the country turned to a rather substantial surplus. How does that fit in to your assessment of these two parties? The Democrat, you saw Bill Clinton before his heart attack at the Democratic Convention saying, look, we found the way. It wasn't the old way. It was kind of a new Democrat way, and it brought unprecedented prosperity, and it got rid of that red ink, and it put the country on a path toward quite substantial surpluses. Does that say to you in any way that the Democrats have learned something, that they deserve a little slack from your assessment?
I think what we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years is what Pat Buchanan calls startling recklessness, I believe he refers to it in his book.
But those are GOP years.
And I think the Democrats are saying, well, what the hell, damn the torpedoes, if the Republicans can cut taxes and spend money, you know, why can't we get what we want? And don't misunderstand, I'm a great admirer of what Bob Rubin in particular
did under Bill Clinton.
With
there.
Bill Clinton in the 1990s, but then with some Republican help. And what's happened now is we've lost our moorings. For example, in the 90s, we not only had a slight tax increase, you recall, on fat cats like me and perhaps you, I don't know.
I think it's you.
But
sir.
We also had pay-as-you-go budget restraints. We had spending caps on discretionary spending.
My party has
gotten rid of all of those. So this is a new theology that I'm seeing here that I don't recall before in my party.
Pete Peterson, we have callers who want to talk to you. I want to invite them in. David is calling from Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
There's so many points. It's unbelievable. But you start off with, there are more bankruptcies than there are divorces, which is phenomenal. Credit card debt has soared. It's at the highest ever. And then we have George Bush talking about this home ownership is up from 65% to 68%. If you take a look at that, that's all people with no money down, and they get to pay private mortgage insurance. They don't own their homes. Most people don't own their homes. They owe.
But we're supposed to be going into the ownership society with W. Bush.
What about this? We owe all right. 25 cents on every dollar goes to pay for the national deficit? It's incredible. It's almost treasonous.
But David, let me ask you then. When Pete Peterson says, look, part of what we're going to have to do, and we'll come to his prescriptions in a moment, but part of it is you're going to have to save more. How do Americans save more when they're already so indebted?
Well, the way I live is if I can't pay cash, I don't want it. And that's the bottom line. We have to pull in our horns. I mean, if you can't afford it and you can't pay cash, then you shouldn't own it.
Sounds like the future. David, thank you for calling. Pete Peterson, George Bush says he wants to move us into an ownership society. How do you read this code? Is this just a way of, you're describing pretty choppy waters ahead. Is it every man on his own, every woman on her own?
I must tell you, when I talk about the immorality of what we're doing, because all we're doing is shifting the debts and bills, you know, to our own kids for our free lunch, I am I don't know, less than amused at the amnesia and the anesthesia that the politicians use. Let's go through what they're telling us. They pass a Sarbanes-Oxley bill, don't they,
mm-hmm.
that says that a corporation goes to jail, the officers, if they don't disclose their liabilities. As Jack pointed out, the Social Security Administration says there's $44 trillion of unfunded liabilities. That is, we don't have the funds for the obligations. If you go out indefinitely, Jack, the number is $73 trillion. Now, how big is that? The entire net worth of America is $42 trillion. And one of my budget reforms that's fanciful is I suggest that the public budget should be put under the same laws as we require of corporations. Now, if we did that and we funded our pensions the way we require corporations to do, where we actually set the money aside instead of phony trust funds that shouldn't be trusted and aren't funded at all, it would add over $1.5 trillion to the budget that the public does not even see.
Pete Peterson,
so we're engaged here in a massive amount of disinformation. Politicians say, I'm not going to pass on my problem, you know, the problems
right.
for the next generation.
And yet they
well,
do.
Who the hell are we passing them on to?
But
or it's your money. You deserve it to spend it as you see fit. Well, who does the debt belong to? The ages? Or this is a social contract, you know?
Yeah.
And when I went to business school, there was a minimum requirement for a contract, and that was there was a meeting of minds of the parties. And recently, at a book party people gave for me, I brought up on the stage my 7-year-old wonderful granddaughter, Chloe Kimball.
Yeah.
And I said to her, darling, I understand there's a contract out there. Have you signed on to $45 trillion of unfunded liabilities? And this adorable little girl says, Papa, is a trillion more than a billion? And I said, yes, darling, it's 1,000 times more. And she says, wow, I'm going to have to sell a lot more lemonade indeed. So we're anesthetizing the public with trust funds that are an oxymoron.
We want to come to your solutions, but there's a break coming up here. I just want to put this to Jack. Jack, does this country have the political wherewithal, the sort of stomach to face up to its own problems? It's like a household so deep in debt it can't talk about it.
Well, the usual cliche is that we need a domestic Pearl Harbor to change anything, and I suppose that would be the hard landing. But, you know, remedies are not all that hard to see. I mean, some people say if you scrap the cap, the $76,000 a year cap on Social Security taxes, you can get somewhat, some people say more than two-thirds or three-quarters even of the funding gap in Social Security. Peter Ozag at the Brookings Institute says if you, the Bush tax cut over, if he makes his tax cuts permanent,
yeah.
that over 75 years will be $11 trillion, three times the Social Security shortfall, and nearly the same size as Social Security and medical and Medicare hospital insurance shortfalls combined.
Hold on.
Do you want those tax cuts or do you want your funding?
We don't know what we want these days. It looks like a problem. We're talking with Pete Peterson. His new book is Running on Empty. You can join the conversation 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former Commerce Secretary Pete Peterson. His new book is Running on Empty, How the Democratic and Republican Parties Are Bankrupting Our Future and What Americans Can Do About It. And if you are listening closely, it is pretty worrying. You can join the conversation tonight. Is Pete Peterson too gloomy? Will the United States, with hard work and luck, pull it out yet again? Or if there's something insoluble here, is democracy somehow itself the problem? Will we always vote for a good story over hard reality? And this, are Republicans and Democrats equally to blame even after the Clinton surplus? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jerry's calling from Pittsboro, North Carolina. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Thanks. I just I want to raise a question about alternatives, and I want to point to sort of a middleman kind of mentality that has taken over 50% of our tax money.
What do you mean, Jerry?
And that is that we have become addicted to supporting conflict and going in. And I'll mention three countries very briefly: Israel, Palestine, Venezuela, and North and South Korea. we say to Israel, well, you can have it all, and we'll stand with you no matter what. In Venezuela, they've got oil, and our government keeps messing with their government, trying to change the government, when that's one of the very few countries that actually gives their people some benefit from the oil. They're trying to give homeless people who live in, you know, at the edge of the capital.
Yeah, we know the story. And the Koreans, yeah. What's your point there?
And Korea, I think my impression is that Koreans believe that they're being kept from reuniting and really settling things after all.
So are you saying when we talk about pulling in our horns, let's pull in our foreign spending, our foreign policy?
Exactly. This is, I think there's been some very crafty work that has commandeered, taken over a lot of the high levels of both parties to assumptions that are now being operated through politics of fear.
We've got it. Jerry, let us take it right there. Pete Peterson, we want to get to your entire list on the prescription front, but let's go first to this issue of America's place and role in the world. Is there something about the way we're acting globally, geostrategically, that's aggravating the deficit problem? Do you see these two things intersecting?
Well, indeed, one of the fascinating questions that needed to be raised, and that's why I've said we've got some trade-offs between national security, retirement security, economic security, and our needs at home. Jack is a much better historian than I am. But, Jack, when in world history has a country for any extended period been the biggest borrower and the biggest debtor?
It didn't happen. I mean, Great Britain was the biggest loaner, but they had some big trade problems, but they always were loaning money to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Are you saying you can't have it both ways? So what does that mean for U.S. foreign policy?
I think one of the fascinating questions that's going to rise, and you and I have not had a chance to discuss the third thing that's different than what it was before. Mm. Most people do not understand that the rest of the world is aging far faster than we are, and their problem with their Social Security and health care programs are much worse than ours.
The rest of the industrial world, anyway.
The industrial world. Their birth rates are far below the replacement rate, so they are going to face a stunning fall in the number of young tax-paying workers. Japan, for example, loses 25% of their workers under the age of 30 in the next 10 years. Their benefits are much higher. Their taxes are already enormous. In Europe, just the payroll taxes are 35% of payroll compared to 15 here.
So are you saying they're not going to have the capital to ship to America anymore soon?
That is certainly one thing that's going to happen. I'll tell you a very brief story of a discussion with the Japanese former Vice Minister of Finance, Mr. Kuroda, just to illustrate the point. I said, Mr. Kuroda, you're going to have a big problem with aging society and the costs of the senior programs. Oh, yeah, yes, Mr. Peterson, big problem. How are you going to finance those, Mr. Kuroda? He says, well, unlike you, we have big savings rate and big current account surplus. We can use that for a while. But I said, Mr. Kuroda, you're financing 25% of our current account deficit. Have you figured out how to spend the same money twice? Ah, Mr. Peterson, very difficult problem. So the rest of the world is going to be hit sooner and harder than we. And there are not only questions here, Jack, of whether they can continue lending us money, but given the enormous political power of the gray lobby, you know, the elderly lobby, mm-hmm. What is this going to do to national security and development budgets all over the developed world? I think it's a very profound question myself.
Pete, we have 5 minutes, and we want to hear your solutions. Give them to us in short form so we can understand the Pete Peterson way out of this hole.
Well, let me give you... We probably only have time to discuss Social Security. Let me do that. One of the things the politicians tell us, among many that are not true, is that we can grow out of the Social Security problem.
George Bush says that.
Yeah, and as do many people. Now, why is that not plausible? Most Americans understand, sir, that Social Security benefits are indexed to inflation, you know, 100% cost of living allowances. Mm. What most Americans don't know is they're also indexed to average wages increases.
Right.
Now, as economies grow, as productivity grows, so do wages grow. But alas, so do the costs of the benefits grow. So it's very difficult to grow out of the Social Security program.
So do you have to cut
My proposal is an idea that's what Lady Thatcher did, and I think it's one that can be explained to children and adults. And I'd like to envision a family discussion here where everybody knows what the reality is.
Okay.
What we would say is the following. To the young people, we would say, you know, a lot of you say you're not going to get your benefits anyway. And besides, you just discovered you're confronting huge payroll tax increases, which lowers whatever you're getting. We're going to work out an arrangement where you get the same benefits as your parents after inflation, so that the poor people who need the benefits get them, and we don't have this safety net being shredded. Now, the second thing that has to happen, in my opinion, and I know some people think this is a shocking proposal from a Republican, but I've thought about it at some length. This country needs to save more. Now, I chaired a committee on capital formation for the Clinton administration and the Congress, and capital formation, you know, is a fancy word for savings. Mm. And I had some great economists from MIT, Harvard, Stanford, et cetera, who were experts in the economics of savings. And I said to them, look, we all agree we've got to increase net national savings so we don't depend on the rest of the world and we can finance our own investments.
How do you do it?
How effective are the current tax incentives? And they said, well, frankly, they have limited and ambiguous effects because quite a few of the people, you know, that would save anyway use these tax incentives. I said, what are you guys talking about then? You say we got to increase savings. How do we do it? They were virtually unanimous. We have to make it mandatory because our culture has become so consumption obsessed, so boomer like that we got to have it all and spend, you know, and
so the government would say you must save what percent
you
of your income?
Save,
how much?
And my proposal is the following: 2 to 3% of pay. You got to take it out of the hands of the government because those guys have established for the last 50 years their surplus, whatever you call the trust fund or whatever you want to call it, they're going to spend it, the lockbox.
Every year for my working life, when do I get the savings back? At retirement?
Okay. And at the time of retirement, you'd get them back. That money would be invested in the private sector, not in individual accounts that tend to be very small, but they would be put in index funds globally. Equities and fixed income. They would be managed by a public-private sector board. Every quarter or so, you would get a report on what's in your account.
We've got a minute left. How big an impact would that have? Does that solve the problem?
Well, it would have an enormous impact because it would dramatically increase the savings of this country. So if we got rid of the budget deficits, which are, you know, scheduled to be in the stratosphere, and we added this layer of savings, it would make a very big difference in the United States.
Pete Peterson, we've got half a minute left. One question. Who are you voting for, Bush or Kerry?
I've been asked that 100 times, and I'm a gifted punter because, among other things, I've written this book, and I don't want to get in the middle of politics. And secondly, while my enthusiasm for Bush fiscal policies is, shall we say, pretty restrained, I really don't know yet what John Kerry is going to do. If I were thoroughly convinced that people like Bob Rubin and Roger Altman and Gene Sperling were going to be very strong voices, that would have an impact on what I decide.
Sounds like a little wiggle room there. Pete Peterson, we're going to have you back for the rest of this story, but thank you very much for joining us tonight. Just great having
you. My pleasure, and good luck to you, Jack.
Nice to have you on, Pete.
Peter G. Peterson, former Commerce Secretary and author of the new book, Running on Empty, How the Democratic and Republican Parties Are Bankrupting Our Future and What Americans Can Do About It. Jack, you know, agree or disagree with the details, I'd like to hear more voices like that in our political conversation.
He is a reformer, and he reminds me of Matthew Arnold's line about his father, a great Victorian reformer. He said, when the foots of folly fall, let them find thy body by the wall.
Bring on Pete. Thanks, Jack. In a moment, John Kerry sharpens his critique of President Bush's economic record. This is On Point. In what his aides are calling his most important economic address of the campaign, Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry lashed out at President Bush's economic record today and accused the Bush presidency of, or accused President Bush of presiding over a, quote, excuse presidency, excuse me. In a sharply worded speech, Kerry said the president must accept responsibility for the loss of jobs that has occurred on his watch and stop blaming outside factors. Quote, President Bush's desk isn't where the buck stops, said the senator, told the Detroit Economic Club. It's where the blame begins. Here's an excerpt from Kerry's address.
1.6 million jobs lost. The first president in 72 years to actually lose jobs on his watch. 8 million Americans are now looking for work. 45 million Americans have no health insurance at all. 5 million more than the day that this president took office. 4.3 million Americans have slipped into poverty over the last 4 years. 1.3 million are children. The average family in America saw their income fall by $1,500 while they simultaneously saw the cost of health care, child care, gasoline, tuition rise faster than ever before. 220,000 of our young people did not attend college last year for the simple reason that they couldn't afford it, couldn't get the loans. Loans came down, prices went up, and they were priced out of an education in America. This president consciously, willfully turned a $5.6 trillion surplus into trillions of debt for our children. George Bush accomplished this, all of it, in only 4 years. Imagine what he could do in another 4 years. I want to be clear, my friends. I'm not saying that the president wanted these consequences, but I am saying that by his judgments, by his priorities, by the decisions he made, he has caused these things to happen or to grow significantly worse. And he refuses to admit the error of those choices. At that convention in New York the other week, President Bush talked about the ownership society. Well, let me just say clearly, Mr. President, when it comes to your record, we agree. You own it. Now, the president wants you to believe that this record is the record of the victim of circumstances, the result of bad luck, not bad decisions. But I would remind you, ladies and gentlemen, Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman were fighting a war. Lyndon Johnson, John Kennedy, Richard Nixon, Gerry Ford, the aftermath and the product of a war. They had recessions. 11 presidents all created jobs, all responded to the needs and made better choices. President Bush has faced these circumstances and faced the wrong circumstances and made the wrong choices. In fact, this president has created more excuses than jobs. His is the excuse presidency.
Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry speaking before the Detroit Economic Club earlier today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.